industrial accidents,
ancient
solving
poisoners,
crime,
poison
chemical
prevention.
Spills. This is Toxic History.
Pharmacist Natalie Ryan is the managing director of the Central Ohio Poison Center Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio, and is a clinical assistant professor of pharmacy practice at Northeast Ohio Medical University.
Thank you again for inviting me for that introduction. I will give you guys just a quick proviso right up front. This topic is really big. There's lots of different aspects of it to cover, so I'll at least try to hit some of the highlights. And if anything, I hope it just encourages you to look into this topic a little bit more and read the book for yourself, listen to some podcasts about it, because it's a pretty fascinating topic all around. So let's just jump right in here. So a few objectives for you. We'll talk very briefly about the discovery and uses of radium, talk about some of the health effects of radium exposure on the dial painters, and then we'll discuss the impact of the Radium Girl story on labor rates and occupational health standards. Hard to talk about this topic without starting back in 1898 with Marie and Pierre Curie's work. So we have a curious discovery. They purified from uranium ore radium, which very difficult to extract. It's only present in concentrations of a fraction of a gram per ton. Most stable isotope is going to be radium-226, and it's an alpha emitter. Radium-228, I only want to bring up briefly, referred to as mesothorium. It'll come back later in one of our cases, but chemically identical, but it's cheaper. It has greater practical luminosity, and it was a byproduct of processing thorium ore. So keep that in mind. We'll come back to mesothorium a little bit later, but just keep in mind this highly radioactive isotope has a half-life of 1,600 years, so it hangs around a good long time. So with that, at the turn of the century, begins the radium craze. So it was widely championed as the greatest find of history. So I'm going to put up a series of different ads. Undark was one of the brands of the radium-infused paint that was used. In the center, you'll see ads for Franklin, Simon & Company. So these are watches that had the luminescent watch faces. And you'll see a series of ads. And so early on, people learned quickly about its ability to destroy human tissue. So it was used to battle cancerous tumors with pretty successful results. Dr. Howard Kelly at Johns Hopkins was using it to treat cervical and uterine cancers. And then as time went on, radium was found in all different kinds of products. So toothpaste, facial creams, food items. And of course, you know, with some of the therapeutic uses that it had came some of the quack products too. So there's different kinds of suppositories, radium tablets that were supposed to give you energy. There was even like a jockstrap product that was sold and marketed. And as you can see here, there's Radithor that's on there and meant to treat, you know, arthritis, rheumatism, neuritis, gives men superpowers. You can get a facelift without having any sort of plastic surgery. And on here, you can see radium was commonly referred to as liquid sunshine. And I focus on the bottom part of that ad. It was harmless in every respect. And if anything, you should just beware of any imitations, you know, fake products that don't really have radium in them. But it was widely regarded as a magnificent cure-all. Hay fever, gout, constipation. There were all different kinds of dressings and pills. There were radium clinics around for those that could actually afford them. And I think if you saw this red graphic there, this water jar, it was like a radium infused lining, and you could put water in that and drink radium infused water. But those, I think, ran even back then about $200. So keep in mind, you know, it was widespread. It was really popular, but only if you had the money and ability to access those products. So this is just another one-page ad of some of the radium products. And all I really did here was just blow up. You could see those products a little bit closer since it's kind of hard to see on the slide. You can look down the list there on the right and you can see there's night cream, there's rouge, vanishing cream, talc powder, hair tonic, all different kinds of things had radium infused into it. So with that radium craze brought us a glamorous new industry. So step back to 1917, think about it. You're a young teenager, you're out there, you're looking for work potentially. And so that brings us a young lady by the name of Catherine Schaub. So, you know, radium entranced most people, you know, it was such a fascinating topic. It was just widely popular, you know, it cured everything. It was in high demand and it was really expensive. Then comes along the radium dial companies. Catherine Schaub, she had a friend that started work in one of these radium factories, And, you know, she described it, you know, it wasn't even a normal factory job. It was actually, it wasn't even called a factory. It was a studio. And, you know, it was, you know, you can see one of the pictures here depicted on the slide. You know, it was women just there, they're painting dials. You know, you could be a little bit of an artist. And so, you know, it was a really attractive job, especially for really young women. You know, it wasn't a typical factory. So these sorts of places became more and more popular. And the ad that I have there in the middle is a little bit later, out in 1922. But you can see these ads were started to put out by companies trying to get the services of girls to come in and do these studio jobs. So with that, Catherine Schaub started working in one of these plants in Newark, New Jersey. And the U.S. entered World War I in April of 1917. So just a couple of months before World War I started, she took this job. And then as the U.S. entered the war, that increased the demand for radium dial painters. So that led to the formation of the Radium Luminous Material Corporation. And then they quickly expanded to have some other studios. And they built a whole new place just because the original place was so small. And that was out in Orange. But then after that, Armistice Day came around on November 11th, 1918. And by that point, the war was over. And so the demand for these products, you would think that maybe might slow down. So they were used in different airplane instruments, watches, you know, because the dials glowed in the dark and they were really useful and helpful to the troops. So a lot of women thought that these were patriotic jobs. They were doing, you know, their share to help out the efforts overseas. And so they became really popular jobs. But as the war was over, some women at that point had left jobs, left to get married or go on to other things. But a good number of the women did stay around. And even as of like 1919, Catherine had only been there a couple of years, and her first instance of having any kind of weird symptoms was she noticed that she was just getting acne on her face, but she went to the doctor and they told her, well, you know, you're a teenager and acne is kind of a normal thing. And so really nothing was thought of that. And, you know, that will come back a little bit later. Another important update would be that in the summer of 1921, George Willis, and that's a name you might want to remember, George Willis and Sabin von Zetrocki, they were the co-founders of that original Radium Luminous Material Corporation. And George Willis sold a bunch of his shares, and the company's treasurer actually bought up a bunch of those shares and then slipped into that president's chair and then kicked both of those two men out. The two people that had, you know, discovered that paint, founded the company, and then that's what led to the formation of the United States Radium Corporation. As 1919 went on, Catherine, one of the dial painters, she had that acne issue. It went away. But even by just a couple of years in, she was already starting to feel like her legs were cracking. There was some stiffness there. But, you know, the company was cranking out millions of these luminous dials, luminous watches. So you'd probably feel a little bit symptomatic too, right? And then the other thing that was important, the women that worked in these companies were paid per dial that they were putting out. So the more dials they could make, the more money they could make. And so every effort to be efficient and quick at the process was really important to the women. So if you look into these cases, like you'll see a common theme of lip dip paint. So they use these very, very, very thin paint brushes. I think there were maybe 30 really fine camel hairs that were in them. And so like as you dipped it in the paint and started to do the tracings for the numbers on the dial, the bristles would spread. So a lot of the women were taught to make it a little bit quicker, to make their lines more precise. They would actually wet the brush in their mouth. And so that would be, they would lip, dip, and paint. And so some did it more than others. And that was just kind of the process. And then as these women were working these jobs, I put glamorous here for a reason. And so in these communities, these women were looked up to. Unfortunately, with the way the conditions were, it was really difficult not to have radium on you somehow. So they were doing this lip dip paint method, then it would get on their clothes, it would get on their skin. And, you know, they would go out and in the evening to be with their friends. And, you know, the radium worker or the dial painters were actually glowing. Their clothes were glowing. Their cheeks were glowing. And even some of the girls at night, like, would notice that eventually, like, their dresses and their clothes, like, when they took them up and hung them up for the night, like, in their rooms, they were glowing. So very popular and just hard to get away from the paint. And it just got into and on everything. So that brings us to Amelia Molly Maggia, and she was one of the original dial painters that was hired at the firm based in Newark. She'd been there a few years, and this is kind of what started to happen for a lot of these painters. So for weeks, she had a really bad tooth. She had it pulled, and her gums remained incredibly sore. So she told herself, you know, she let a couple of months go by, never got better. So she ended up going to a different dentist. And so that happened in October of 1921. And by that point, the pain in her lower gum and jaw became unbearable. So when Dr. Neff, that was her dentist, first saw her, he treated her for pyorrhea. And everything he seemed to do just made things worse. So he would extract a tooth, that spot wouldn't heal. And then just extraction after extraction, all it seemed to do was just sprout like more agonizing ulcers. And so unfortunately for Molly, she just continued to get worse and worse and worse. And it got to a point where her teeth would just start to fall out on her own. Nothing Dr. Neff seemed to do seemed to arrest or stop that disintegration from happening. You know, they're trying to figure out what could possibly be causing this. And so unfortunately, you know, she had sores in the mouth. She then started to complain of joint pain, extreme tiredness. And of course, you know, she was a young single woman living outside of her home. So of course, it had to be syphilis. They did test her a couple of times. The first test was negative. They first tested her in 1922. And as Dr. Neff continued to treat her, he started to notice a different type of odor from what he'd previously observed in other necrosis of the jaw cases. And he actually had the thought that maybe she was actually being poisoned by phosphorus somehow. And what was happening to her was phossy jaw. So then he started to ask her about her employment, and she talked to him about the radium company that she worked at. This dentist attempted to go to that firm, try to get a sample of the paint, and he was pretty much refused. But eventually, her entire lower jaw, the roof of her mouth, they just all became like one huge abscess. And as her case progressed, she was limping into the office, and, you know, she had this bad rheumatism in her hips and her feet. And one of the days that he was treating her, he was just touching around inside of her mouth, and things had deteriorated so much that he'd gone in and he had lifted out like her jaw, like it just came out in his hands. And so that's kind of what started to happen. And Molly was just like the first of these. So unfortunately, she passed away in September of 1922 at just 24 years old. So again, she started having these pains in October of 21. And then by September, she had already passed away. The disease had spread to her throat and it just ate through her jugular vein. And they tell a pretty harrowing story in the book about how her sister was with her and just essentially watched her drown in a river of blood. So a pretty, pretty terrible death. And she was not going to be the first one that this sort of thing happened to. Oh, and of course, then came, you know, they had the burial and everything. And without having any other idea of what could have happened, you know, they just attributed the cause of her death to syphilis, which was unfortunate. And that would also come back later. As months go on, more and more girls fall ill. Another dial painter, Irene Rudolph, she'd been experiencing dental trouble similar to what Molly had. And in speaking with her physician, she and one of the other girls just thought their symptoms were just way too similar. And so her physician, Dr. Allen, reported the case to the Industrial Hygiene Division. So there was an initial inspection of the practice of lip pointing. So the VP of the United States Radium Company, he apparently had told them, you know, he warned those girls time and time again that they needed to stop that lip pointing. But, you know, that didn't actually happen because the girls probably would have stopped that had they been told that. And they'd even asked if that was going to be a process that would hurt them or not. And so really, the company just kind of seemed like they didn't really want to interfere with the girls' work and they didn't care how it was done. Just don't waste material, get the dials painted, and how it happened didn't really matter. But the inspector that went on that initial visit noticed that other girls were already limping. He took some samples to test and then asked the Department of Labor to inspect since it was out of their jurisdiction. So then John Roach, the director of the Department of Labor at the time, had launch that inspection. And so the first inspector, Lillian Erskine, her degree of investigation was speaking with a radium authority. And in her discussion with that person, they said, nope, there's never been any reports of necrosed bones as a result of radium treatment. So she just said it was an accidental coincidence and it was probably incompetent dental surgery, which was a pretty bold claim to make without really looking into it. And then there's Dr. Smets-Tolsky in January 1923. He believed before he had even looked into much that he guessed that it was the influence of radium that had done this to the girls. And at the time, that was an insanely radical statement to make, because remember how popular radium was. It was a cure-all, widely reported, widely reused health aid. While his claim was pretty radical, he had a lot of science to back him. The United States Radium Company themselves had a bibliography of various radium studies, only published a couple of months before he was even involved in the case. And one of those articles was titled Radium Dangers, Injurious Effects. So in that bibliography, there were articles that dated back to 1906 on the damage that radium could cause. There was the death of a German woman in 1912 that was reported in literature attributed radium poisoning. And then even as early as 1914, like, there was knowledge of radium's ability to deposit in bone like calcium does and then cause changes in blood. So they did have some knowledge. And alternatively, so there was some good evidence that showed, yes, radium could be harmful, but there was a lot of positive literature that was out there that supported how great radium was. And not surprisingly, those researchers who put out all of that positive literature actually worked for the radium firms. This physician was pretty confident in his theory, despite all of the loud, well-funded voices that were very much against him, because, you know, radium was such a great way to make money. It was a business that was flourishing. He had a lot of voices against him. And so before he even finished all of his testing, he added on to his recommendations that every single operator be warned of the dangers of getting this material on the skin, in the system, especially getting it in the mouth, and that they be forced to use the utmost cleanliness. You remember I talked about George Willis, who was one of the co-founders. So just a month or so after Molly had passed away, he had started to fall ill. And, you know, throughout his time at the company, he thoughtlessly carried those tubes of radium with his bare hands every day at work. And that same month that Molly died, he had his right thumb amputated, and the testing revealed that it was completely riddled with cancer. And he didn't hide any of that from anybody. So he worked with another physician and published his findings in JAMA, and still no one seemed to notice. Some of the findings from his own case report are quoted down there below. The reputation for harmlessness enjoyed by radium may not, after all, depend on the fact that so far, not very many people had been exposed to large amounts of radium, and that there was good reason to fear that neglect of precautions may result in serious injury. So even then, you know, this is one of the co-founders, this is published in JAMA, and still, like, those warnings were all there in the early 1920s, and they just were ignored. And then by April of 1923, Dr. Smets-Tolsky, he concluded his testing, and again, he said, I feel quite sure that the opinion expressed in my former letter is correct, and such trouble may have caused this. The trouble was probably caused due to radium. But again, all of those things were ignored. And so as we move into February 1924, more and more girls became ill. Recruiting by the companies became really, really difficult, and production slowed. And other girls had passed. So Irene and Helen, that were kind of the reason for that initial investigation, they had passed away, and their deaths were attributed to phosphorus poisoning. Helen's was due to Vincent's angina. So basically nothing that had anything to do with their occupation or anything else like that. And again, so there were a lot of other girls ailing as well. So to move the story forward a little bit, Grace Vincent was Hazel's mother. She went to the studio after watching her daughter suffer so much, and she left a note there that she was going to make a claim for compensation on account of her daughter's illness. And only now did the company decide, okay, maybe we should take a look and see if this is actually going to harm anybody, even though they had already had previous hints early on that it was actually harmful. And so out of that came the Drinker report. Something interesting that you should look. So Drs. Cecil and Catherine Drinker, they did some work and examined the girls, and they concluded that the workforce was in fact being contaminated by radium. Unfortunately, their report never reached the New Jersey government. it turns out Mr. Arthur Roeder, he was the head of the company at the time. He had falsified the report and submitted that to the New Jersey government and just gave the company a clean bill of health that, you know, everything, all the patients were fine. Later on, the drinkers found out about that and they ended up publishing their findings, much to the discontent of the United States Radium Company. And from there, the United States Radium Company just, they went on a misinformation spree and just tried to attribute everything to the patient had syphilis, the patient had everything but this. Quickly then, Dr. Frederick Flynn, he was someone that was working somewhere else. He was a physician that was hired on by the United States Radium Company, but he'd been around. He was very supportive of radium. Grace Fryer was another one of these radium dial painters. She started to have problems again in 1922. Her doctor suggested that jaw problems were related to radium painting. And so this Dr. Flynn took an interest in her, did an extensive exam, as he did for many other girls, and, you know, told her that she was perfectly fine. She was healthier than he was. None of these problems could be attributed to radium. And fortunately for her, she was not persuaded, but there were many others that were not so lucky. Later, it was discovered that this guy, Dr. Frederick Flynn, wasn't even a licensed physician. So a guy on the company payroll going around to all of these women, telling them that they were fine, nothing was wrong with them. And, you know, that eventually kept them from launching lawsuits against people or against the company. So with this, as things progressed, five of those dial painters in the summer of 1927, they eventually brought lawsuit to the United States Radium Corporation. And so I've got their names listed there. And, you know, one of the difficulties was just finding a lawyer to represent them. They fought against statute of limitations. Some of those were only 6 months and it varied between the two states. But this lawyer, he was aware of the Waterbury Clock Company having cases of radium poisoning out in Connecticut. And so he was excited to take this case because he had a means to say, I know of these cases. All I have to do is go talk to the Workmen's Compensation Commission in Connecticut because they had a much more forgiving statute of limitations. It was 5 years. When he inquired, no one had said anything at all about having radium poisoning. And it was because this Dr. Flynn that we just talked about was out there, you know, painting himself as the concerned medical expert, trying to, and just persuading all of these dial painters to accept settlements quietly out of the media. And so no one ever reported these. And so there was nothing else that Raymond Berry was able to link them to. But they did get their day in court. Testimony occurred in January and April of 1928. And keep in mind, this group of girls, two of them were already bedridden by the time they got here. And they were so weak that they couldn't even hold their hand up to take the oath when they were testifying. And so the United States Radium Company, they wanted to have an adjournment. They needed to delay proceedings. And if anyone wants to have a guess why that might have happened, they had some of their witnesses that were vacationing in Europe across. So they were vacationing across seasons. So they needed to wait until September. And so these women are actively dying and, you know, they wanted to adjourn. And so not surprisingly, the public got really, really upset with that. The girls went to the media. That's where they were termed the Radium Girls. And it was decided that after some back and forth, the women just decided to accept an out-of-court settlement just because a lot of them likely weren't going to live until September to even see any fruits of their labors and trying to get to hold this company to account. And so the terms of their settlement, they got $10,000 as a cash lump sum for each, a $600 pension, and then past and future medical expenses were paid. And then the United States Radium Company was to cover all court costs. So great news, right? This was a huge win. There was nothing else like this. But with that, the firm was not found to be negligent. The claims of the plaintiffs were barred by the statute of limitations. So really, they said, like, sure, we'll go ahead and pay you out of court, but it's not because we did anything wrong. It's not because what your work was linked to your problems. We're just purely being humanitarian here. And one of the other things they did that is particularly awful is, you know, they set up this committee of physicians that set up to regularly meet and examine the women, check on their progress, you know, to look for a cure, that sort of thing. But if they at any point were found to no longer be suffering from radium poisoning, the payments were to cease. And so for these women, for the next few years, they were subjected to multiple invasive testing. And those physicians did, you know, the physicians in the company did nothing but try to get out of having to pay those women what they were owed. And, you know, the women were so frail that even getting a simple scratch or anything would nearly be a death sentence just because their wounds and such didn't heal. And so I want to be mindful of time. So I'm looking, so there was another case back in Ottawa. And so, you know, the New Jersey case made international news. So the women saw all of this in the press in Ottawa thinking, oh my gosh, like we all have toothaches. We sound just like this. And so there was a lot of panic. The radium dial company, they brought experts in to run medical tests, even though they'd already done that back in 1925. Those results had never been shared. So 3 days after that New Jersey settlement, Radium Dial put out a full page ad about the results of all of this medical testing that they had been doing. So they talked about the thorough medical exams that they've been doing throughout the course of women's employment to talk about this so-called radium poisoning. Just some of the language that they use is kind of infuriating if you go back and read some of this. But they published that nothing even approaching such symptoms or conditions had ever been found. These women were fine. They were especially okay because the cases that were reported up on the East Coast, they used paint made from mesothorium, but Radium Dial only used pure radium. So think about this, like these women are sick, they're very debilitated, they can't work, and they're fighting and fighting and fighting just to have their day in court, just to be listened to and not be thought to be dying from syphilis or some other disease. Now, I point this out because of Eben Byers. So he was a world-renowned industrialist, a wealthy man who raced horses, high profile and important. And he was prescribed Radithor, one of these radium treatments for an injury back in 1927. And he eventually... go Google and look at the pictures. I just didn't want to put it on the slide because it is pretty horrific. He had lost all of his jaw. It just fell off. And before he died, he submitted his case findings to the FTC. And wouldn't you know, that one thing, in December of 1931, the FTC issued a cease and desist and the FDA declared radium medicines illegal and AMA removed radium from all of their list of enemies. So think about all of the struggle that these women are going through. And then this one guy has this incident, says radium is killing me. And then just immediately, boom, these products are gone. The Ottawa group of girls, they eventually, they went through the same kind of process that the first group did, but it took them a long time to find legal representation. They were also finding statute of limitations issues, but they found Mr. Grossman and he reported them and he was found 2 days before the trial date and then proceedings started within February. And then they decided to form this group of the Society of the Living Dead. So I have their names there for you. And their whole goal was to obtain better protection by legislation and otherwise for persons endangered by occupational disease. Leonard Grossman was an early supporter of the suffragettes. He was a great orator. He was always in the media. And so between when the suit was first launched and testimony started in March, the verdict came in 1938. And the Industrial Commission found that there was a relation of the employer and employee between Catherine Donahue. So she was one of the main ones that was part of that group. And they did find the firm guilty. And so these were what was awarded to Catherine Donahue. So her past medical expenses, her back salary for the entire period, she'd been unable to find work, she had been let go by the company in 1931. She got damages and then an annual life pension as well. And then again, Radium Dial disagreed. So they filed appeal after appeal. So the first one was unanimously denied by the commission. And unfortunately, Catherine Donahue died July 27th, 1938, and it was the day after Radium Dial had filed their second appeal. So that, you know, made press itself. And then by October 23rd of 1939, these appeals went to the United States Supreme Court, and they dismissed that appeal, and the lower court ruling was upheld. So a couple of things, these girls did not die in vain. They made every second count. So just thinking throughout history, World War II, there was a new demand for dial painters, but by now they knew of those dangers. There were new safety standards there. Workers of the Manhattan Project followed those radium standards. So they were not negotiable. And then the 1950s nuclear arms race, you know, there was a renewed interest in some of these newer materials and strontium-90 came into play. But after some investigation with the Center for Human Radiobiology in partnership with the Argonne National Laboratory, eventually in 1963, JFK signed the limited test ban, and that prohibited any sort of atomic testing above ground, underwater, and outer space, which all of this research and similarities of radium thought that strontium might be a little bit too dangerous for humanity. And so the dial painters were, their case was credited with the establishment of a lot of different labor laws. So one being the establishment of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And of note, in 1979, the EPA declared the United States Radium Company site in Orange that it had unacceptable environmental hazardous levels of radioactivity, widespread contamination because they dumped waste all over the place. And in 1991, the New Jersey Supreme Court found that company forever liable. And those residents sued and got $14.2 million in damages. And so at the end of the day, against all odds, a few of the women had really great long lives. Pearl Payne was one of the Ottawa girls. She lived to be 98 years old, traveled with her husband all over the world. Charlotte Purcell had developed one of the really bad sarcomas and had actually lost an arm. But she lived to be 82 years old, was adored by her grandchildren. And I think one of the nice things I read about her was that one of her grandkids asked her to learn how to jump rope. She was, you know, kind of a vivacious spirit. She's like, well, I can't really teach you that. I only have one arm. And then she proceeded to just tie the jump rope to a tree and then taught her granddaughter how to jump rope from there. There was legislation in 2011. September 2nd was declared Radium Girls Day in Illinois. And that is a statue that's in Ottawa, Illinois, that's a commemoration of the Radium Girls and recognition of the tremendous perseverance, dedication, and sense of justice that these girls had. So, you know, they were a very close-knit group. They triumphed. They had a lot of really tight friendships. They didn't give up despite everything telling them that they could or should. And they left us an extraordinary legacy. I highly encourage you to read this book because I feel like I could barely touch on everything that was here. But The Radium Girls was the book that I read. There's a couple of plays that are out there. Radium City is a documentary that I think features a couple of the girls from Ottawa. There is, I discovered a movie on Netflix about it. And the podcast that I listen to does a really nice hour and a half summary of that. It's called Morbid. It's a true crime podcast. And with that, those are my references.